I always find it a pleasure to be at IMC because I found this to be a really dedicated, devoted community, and that you came out tonight, could have gone to the movies or watched TV, is to me a reflection of the fact that you care about the Dharma, you care about your life and the direction that you're trying to move in with the Dharma. So it's nice to see you all. I live in the East Bay, and if I didn't, if I lived on the peninsula, I'd be here all the time. But the commute is really not a lot of fun, so I don't come as often as I would like. And I appreciate very much the invitation and the opportunity to talk with you tonight. I'm not trained as a Dharma teacher. As Maureen said, I'm a writer and an editor. I've been involved in practice for a long time and also have a scholarly interest. I did my doctoral work in Asian and comparative studies, and I do some writing in the field. I understand that you have recently completed a 5-week series in the 5 faculties. Is that true for everybody here tonight? No? Yes?
No.
No. Oh. Okay. Well, I had a feeling that it was going to be a 5 faculties group, but if not, that's fine. So for those of you who took that course, I hope that what I say tonight won't be totally redundant, but actually will serve to reinforce what you've learned from the other speakers that were in the series. However, if anyone feels like leaving because you've had up to here with sati, samadhi, virya, sadha, and panya, I will understand and I wouldn't take it personally. So I decided to talk about the 5 faculties because lately, wherever I turn in my work as a writer, there they are. And that's because, as Maureen mentioned, I'm actually working on 2 projects right now. One of them is this book about Manindra. And he was a Bengali teacher who was instrumental in the transmission of the Dharma to the West. And Maureen mentioned some of the names that you're probably familiar with and people whose writings you're familiar with. So there's Joseph Goldstein, Sharon Salzberg, Ram Dass, Daniel Goleman, Lama Surya Das, Kamala Masters, Larry Rosenberg, Christopher Titmus, Christina Feldman, both from the UK, and many, many more. And some people have heard of Manindra and some haven't. But he was really instrumental in making it possible for us to be sitting here today and practicing. Because if he hadn't taught the teachers who have been teaching us, I don't know where we would be. I'm also working on an article about the approach to practice that is taught by Sayadaw Utejaniya. He was here at IMC, I believe it was in June. And so synchronistically, while I was thinking about what these 2 teachers have to say, I happened to read a talk by Bhante Gunaratana, who's a Sri Lankan monk, and he founded a monastery and retreat center in West Virginia. So as I was going through what these teachers, these 3 Theravada teachers are saying, it really felt like a reverberation to me of the Buddha's message about how important these 5 faculties are to practice. And this was true more than 2,500 years ago, when the Buddha was promulgating the Dharma, and it's true today. In fact, when Sayadaw was here in June, he stated unequivocally that the mind and these 5 faculties, not the posture, not whether you're sitting or whether you're standing, whether your eyes are closed or not, but the mind and these five faculties are what make meditation. Just because we're sitting and paying attention doesn't necessarily mean we're meditating. Even animals can pay attention. If an animal wants to eat, that animal pays very close attention to get its prey. So that's not meditation, okay? But we use these five powers to help us do the work of meditation, which is to improve the quality of the mind. That's why I asked you, because this is something that Saida Utejaniya does, that's why I mentioned, notice your attitude as you're observing whatever's arising, those sounds that come up from outside the building. When you hear those sounds, what happens to the mind? Does the mind go out to those sounds? Does the mind want to push those sounds away? It's really important to know how the mind is responding or reacting to what's arising. So one of the things all the teachers point out is the idea that mindfulness or sati in and of itself is not enough. It needs wisdom, panya, or discernment as a partner, because merely paying close attention is something anyone, as I said, an artist, an athlete, an arsonist, or an animal can do. In order for mindfulness to help facilitate liberation from dukkha, from all kinds of pain, it needs to be coupled with wisdom. So these teachers ask, with what understanding are we observing objects? Are we seeing them with a mind that's filled with greed or with generosity? A mind that's dark with aversion and hatred or bright with goodwill? A mind that's clouded with delusion and ignorance or clear with knowledge? And Saida Utejaniya talks about how these defilements or their opposites are the colored lens through which we're seeing things. So if we don't see what that lens is, then that just takes over. And we get carried away with the hatred or, if we're lucky, with the goodwill. What they also point out is if we're identifying with what arises, whatever those thoughts, emotions, sensations, images, and so on that come up, then we're viewing all of this from wrong understanding. We're mistaking what are essentially universal forces of nature. It could be heat, or it could be contraction, anger, sadness, joy. And we're taking them as something personal rather than something that occurs when certain conditions come together. And then we get caught up in storytelling about my frustration, my pain, or my happiness. So without wisdom accompanying what we're noticing, instead of detoxifying ourselves of what the Buddha called the three poisons, the greed, hatred, and delusion, we wind up adding more toxins to our heart and mind. And that in turn, I'm sure many of you have experienced this, that in turn affects the body as well. I noticed this just the other day. My husband and I got into a little snit over something. It was really inconsequential, but I reacted and he reacted. And I was watching the mind and the tension. I mean, it was over, but the tension of it had created pressure in the head. And I thought, here is a defilement in full bloom affecting me physically. And then I was just thinking about how we think that the stress is out there someplace. That's making me feel this way, or that stress is causing me X, Y, and Z. When actually it's what the mind is doing that's creating the tension in the body. And I was watching this because I remember Utejaniya saying, he said, you know, until we really, really experience those defilements, the suffering of them, we're really not going to make any effort to move in a different direction. And I watched the mind. I wasn't willing to let go of my being upset. And I watched how long that stayed as tension in the body and pressure in the head. And I thought, okay, so this is really uncomfortable. Why am I not simply letting go? It's like I wasn't suffering enough yet. Anyway, I did get over it. In fact, my husband drove me down here, so everything's okay. So Sayadaw Utejaniya says that unless we know what attitude the mind holds, unless we know the colored lens through which we're seeing what's happening in our experience, we're not truly meditating. And I'd never heard anybody say this before. It was really an eye-opener for me, and it wasn't as though I'd started practicing last week. And I thought, wow, I'm not really meditating unless I'm aware of this attitude in my mind. And so I got really curious. It really generated a lot of interest in what's going on. And that's why I went through this thing a few days ago of really watching the mind. If we're observing with a greedy mind, can we see the craving, the lust for a certain car or a certain relationship or for fame or wealth or maybe just the chocolate bar? It could be something really simple. Can we see the obverse of that? That in wanting something else, we dislike what we do have. And can we see through all these things that they're all subject to change and thus inherently unsatisfactory, and they're completely impersonal? They're not about me. Part of incorporating wisdom into practice is being interested in and investigating what's going on. And that means not just noting the objects that arise in the field of our experience, but being curious as to how they're affecting us. Does that thought or emotion bring peace or agitation to the mind and body? Is it creating more suffering or reducing it? Well, as I said, I got a good lesson in noticing how I was creating more suffering as long as I was holding on to a particular attitude. It's really possible to work with these faculties and consciously shift. I'm going to tell a story that a woman told me. A woman that I interviewed, I did a lot of interviews for the book on Manindra, and this woman had practiced with him in Bodh Gaya in India decades ago. And she said one time she saw how he applied mindfulness and wisdom together. So they were in a room, this might have been in the Gandhi ashram, and someone came in and told Manindra something that completely enraged him. Now, I've never seen him enraged, so when she told me this story, I was like, wow. Anyhow, she was standing only 6 or 7 feet away, and she could see his face form into a scowl and turn red, and his eyes were just burning. And then she saw his mindfulness just snap into place. And suddenly, he was smiling and loving toward the very same person. Later, he explained the process to her. But in the moment that she watched him transform the rage into love, she thought, wow, this is just miraculous. I mean, she could see his face go red and scowling and then just switch, just drop the whole thing and be warm and friendly and loving in an instant, because his mindfulness snapped into place and he had the wisdom to see what was going on, that this was creating suffering, and he just moved away from it. You might notice this in yourself sometimes, that you catch yourself having a thought or about to say something, and then your mindfulness snaps into place and you think, no, I'm not going to go there. I have a choice, I'm not going to go there. So I'm sure you're all experiencing this at some point. Your mindfulness works, and there's enough wisdom there for the two to combine to change what's happening in the moment. Another theme among the teachers that I've been talking about is the correct way to apply effort or energy, which is called virya. Most of us probably misunderstand this as maximum energy, pedal to the metal. But that's not what this effort or energy is about. I know I misunderstood it for a long time. Munindra and Utejaniya have both talked about the need for the mind to be relaxed, that effort should not be the fierce grind of excessive striving or overexertion, because that just brings about physical and mental exhaustion. Munindra used to say to yogis, slow and steady wins the race, because people wanted to be enlightened already. I mean, I just started meditating, but I want to be enlightened now. And he used to tell them, slow and steady wins the race. Utejaniya makes a comparison between the sustaining, modulated energy that we use to persist to the end of a marathon versus the burst of energy that we apply in a 100-meter dash. You just got to keep going, not burn out all your energy in the first mile. When students used to despair of making any spiritual progress, although they were working desperately hard, Munindra would inform them, continuity is the secret to success. And we need only think of the unhurried tortoise that kept walking until he came to the finish line, while the speedy hare who had bolted ahead stopped to snooze on the side of the road. And so Sayadaw says, this is the kind of effort that we need to make, patient and persistent, to build up momentum for our practice. I had the good fortune of interviewing Sayadaw Utejaniya, and I wanted to know. I asked him, since he encounters so many yogis in Asia and on his visit here, I said, do you find that there are more loose yogis or tight yogis? And he said, oh, more yogis that are too tight. And contrary to my thinking that perhaps this is a byproduct of our super fast overachieving Western society, it turns out that tension has no geographical boundaries. And he said to me, greed is the same everywhere. Everybody wants to get something. It doesn't matter, east, west. Why do we try so hard that it exhausts us? Sayadaw explains that generally we expend a lot of energy when we want something, or we don't like something, or we just don't know what to do. So we just keep trying harder. Perhaps many of you have experienced that when you practice in a relaxed and easy manner, you're actually more likely to establish the right conditions for insight to arise. And for it to arise just naturally, not because you're trying to force anything. We don't have to force anything. I've noticed over the years that whenever I get really tight with striving, it's like squeezing so hard, there's no room for anything to move. But whenever I'm open and easy with the process, rather than craving for something to happen, then insight just happens. Manindra would say when people, you know, wanted something to happen already, when the fruit is ripe, it will fall, he used to say. And people would go back to their practice, okay, okay. And he would tell them to just relax, simple and easy. And everybody was trying so hard. Saito has an interesting and surprising perspective about this. He believes that we don't even have to intentionally work at cultivating loving kindness, metta. He kind of considers it from the opposite end. He said, when there's no hatred in the mind and heart, metta will naturally surface. It's not like you have to be sitting there, I'm going to be loving. I'm really working hard on being a loving person. He said, and in the same way, when we're just relaxed and gentle with ourselves, not violent with ourselves, that we'll naturally be compassionate. We think we have to work so hard to be a certain way, and actually it's there, we just need to let go. So on or off the cushion, things do arise naturally in the absence of tension and craving, and I know this to be true when it comes to my writing, and I'll bet you could think of examples in your own life. When I'm writing, if I expect certain ideas or thoughts, or, you know, I just need that paragraph, or I'm waiting for the ending to this article to just, you know, for everything to fit right. If I want things to surface in that instant, just when I want them, then I'm sure to get frustrated and disappointed. But when I trust that when they'll come in their own time, they always do. I know often I have wanted to finish something, or just I couldn't figure out how something should work in a piece of writing. And I'll get up and go for a walk, or I'll swim, and I'm not even thinking about it. And just as I'm doing my laps, all of a sudden exactly what I need comes, because I've just let go in that moment, and I'm more at ease, and I'm not focusing so hard on it. So it usually happens when I least expect it. All I have to do is create some balance in my effort between not being too loose, in other words, not making any effort, not doing anything, and being too tight. If I just engage in the process rather than remain fixated on the goal, it just comes easily. I'm usually very pleasantly surprised. In fact, the last book I was working on, Discovering the Body's Wisdom, I used an index card to remind me not to strive too hard. And I put this index card above my desk. It's been years, so I don't remember the words exactly, but it went something like this. It was either less effort, greater results, or greater ease, more results, but something like that. And I saw that card every day and I followed it, and it really proved to be so. I really enjoyed myself more and more working on the book, and it just, parts of it just flowed right out. And I've spoken with yogis who have practiced with Saida Utejaniya, and they're reporting that even when meditating was difficult, maybe there was a lot of pain in the body, or maybe there were disturbing thoughts, that staying relaxed and interested in what was going on enabled them to actually enjoy it anyway, as difficult as it was, which came as a big surprise. There was this interest, oh, what is that? Instead of just reacting to it and collapsing behind it. I don't know people's background here. I don't know your personalities. But for those of us who develop striving personalities, anybody here, striving personality? Listening to Sayadaw brings great relief when he starts talking about being relaxed is the best way to do your practice, and that if you are practicing in a way that is exhausting you or discomforting you, then you're not doing it right. Anyway, I found it a real relief to hear him, and a lot of yogis I spoke with felt the same way. How many of us grew up thinking, if I just work harder, then my family will be more loving, or my parents will finally be happy, or I'll be accepted? How much of striving comes from a place, a feeling, I am not enough, or this is not enough, this moment of sitting or walking is not enough, maybe if I tried harder, I could have a spectacular meditative experience, flashing lights and out of body and... Why do we try so hard? What are we trying to get? Why isn't what simply is okay? Why isn't the very act of breathing, of being alive, enough? Why are we afraid to relax? If we relax, does that mean we're falling apart? What are we trying to keep so tightly together? Has anybody here in a state of relaxation felt their body fall apart? Really? I mean, is it like the pieces just collapse on the floor? No. Okay. So, let's just take a moment. You all look pretty relaxed tonight. I don't know what kind of days you had, but... And just bring your shoulders up to your ears and really try hard to make it as tight as you can. Tighter, 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 tighter. Oh! And then let them go. When I do that, I mean, notice how you feel. When I do that, I just wind up feeling a greater sense of space. One of the things that I found interesting in reviewing Sayadaw's and Munindra's teachings is that samadhi should not be narrowly defined as only one-pointedness or concentration. I would imagine you're all familiar with the word samadhi, and most of the time we've heard about it as just being concentrated and focused on one object. But instead, they both talk about it as a relaxed, steady, stable, unified mind. And that can be the result of vipassana, not just of samatha practice. So instead of focusing exclusively on one object to develop concentration, we can maintain a global awareness of multiple objects, which is a lot easier to do in daily life. We can't go around in daily life just focusing on the nuances of our breath. We have things to do. We have people to see. We have places to go. You can't just focus on the in and out of your breathing. So that kind of awareness has to be continuous in order for the mind to become collected and composed, noticing what's going on, noticing the attitude in the mind. And to do this, Sayadaw insists on walking at a normal pace. If you go to his retreat center, you don't see people taking one step in a minute, but just walking normally. He doesn't believe in slowing down, and he certainly doesn't believe in concentrating hard. He says that from his own experience, that sometimes we can concentrate so hard that all we get is a headache, not samadhi. And he told me a story about this. He was really into samadhi. He was blissed out and everything was going great for hours and hours, and it was going so well that he said, okay, I'm not even going to go to sleep. I'm going to stay up all night because the samadhi, this feels so good. And he was doing fine until about 2 a.m. a bed bug bit him, and that broke the samadhi. He got irritated. He just, oh. And then he thought, well, you know, it was going well all day. This is just a second that I got this bite. I'm going to work at this and get back to my samadhi. And he worked at it so hard for days. It wouldn't come back. The samadhi was so elusive. And he just kept trying harder and harder and harder to get that samadhi back until he had such a headache he couldn't take it anymore. And he finally just gave up. He said, that's it. I can't do this anymore. I don't care if the samadhi ever comes back. I'm finished. I'm not going to do this. And in the moment that he let go, the samadhi came back. Because it wasn't until he was able to notice that he had such intense craving for the bliss of the samadhi, and this was just driving him and tightening him. But as soon as he got wind of this and just let go, then it all came back to him. One of the other things that I found out from interviewing people was that yogis who've been on retreat with him have found it revelatory that they could actually achieve samadhi without intensely focusing in a microscopic way or walking at a snail's pace. And I've heard this from teachers as well as yogis. Everybody thought, oh, the only way I'm going to get samadhi is if I just sit for hours and just watch the tiniest, tiniest movement of my breath. So what happens when you have these kinds of experiences, and in this case, revelatory experiences? Well, they help foster another faculty, which is sadha, faith. When we see such positive results from our relaxed efforts, when we experience the benefits of our practice, we're able to grow more confident about the path and our ability to follow it, to walk on it. And it's really one of these, yes, I can do this, and I don't have to tie myself up in knots to do it. While no one else can walk the path for us, there are certain individuals who so clearly embody these qualities or these faculties that we get carried along by the strength of their very presence. Such individuals stimulate and encourage enlightenment factors within ourselves. I interviewed an Australian man who had practiced with Munindra, and I was quite taken by an image he offered about his experience. This is what he told me. Among bike riders, the windbreak is taken by the first person. Then you get in behind and away you go. That's what Munindra was like. He provided the slipstream for people. You felt like you could go forward, but your experience was weightless. Munindra's faith was so palpable that it awakened greater faith in those who practiced with him. Through his example and the results they experienced, they could commit to keep going. His whole being made the possibility of fully waking up come alive for them. So when we have the good fortune to meet or read about someone who's a model of working with the five faculties, and you have a great person here, Gil, we need to welcome that person as an inspiration In turn, in time, we could be such an inspiration to someone else. Everybody here could be an inspiration to someone else. If we complement mindfulness with wisdom, apply the right amount of effort to attain and maintain a steady and stable and composed state of mind, and we trust the path and our ability to walk it, we can find out for ourselves that what the Buddha talked about more than 2,500 years ago is not out of reach for us in the 21st century. I'd like to end with some advice from Sayadaw Utejaniya. Measure your practice by the development of the five faculties: sati, samadhi, virya, sadha, panya. More awareness leads to more samadhi, which leads to more enthusiasm about practice and leads to more understanding. So I hope you'll think about the five faculties whenever you sit down, whenever you walk around, and know that you can apply them anytime, anywhere, because meditation, Sayadaw said, is for all time, anywhere, anytime, night or day, not just for retreat, as he said, not just for having a nice retreat in the forest, you know, all the time. So thank you. If you have any questions or want to talk about anything, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
I have a question. If you're doing mindfulness meditation, and you know you're just staying with the breath, and maybe even aware of how your mind is, you know, what the state of your mind is, if you have like a really great insight, you know, and but you don't want to identify with it, but yet it could really be helpful if you realize this insight, like how would you handle a situation like that?
I'm thinking of something that Sayadaw said, because he encouraged people to inquire, to investigate. I remember thinking, wow, it's okay to think. I misunderstood the teachings originally that I shouldn't think about what comes up. But if you have an insight, what's wrong with exploring it? Not to get attached, my insight. Oh, I'm a great meditator because I had this insight. Right? But to just notice it and then notice how you're feeling about it. You know, are you grabbing onto it or are you just interested in exploring it? That's the way I heard him talk about it. Not to push it away or let it go, but to just, it'll fall away in its own time anyway, but to, yeah, take a look at it. What is it? Don't be shy.
When I was listening to what you said, I was relating to my set, and it just happened to be about the five faculties. Mm. About just whatever's going on, it's okay. Just breathe. But, you know, whatever's going on as it goes in, it's going to go out, and just relax. Right, mm-hmm. And it's all okay, whatever's going on. Mm-hmm. What would you say, and having the insight that's exactly what it should be? No struggle, just that's where the sit is going. And then for you to say the same thing after the sit, is that a connection in that level of us all sitting together?
I don't know. I mean, synchronicity happens all the time. It was, for me, when I was preparing the talk, it was synchronistic that I happened to pick up Bhante Gunaratana's talk, and I didn't even know that he was that was about this. It's just, I think that when we're open and receptive, these connections do happen. You know, we are, to use an old expression, on the same wavelength. I like what you said about it's okay, whatever comes up is okay. One of the people that I spoke with had said to me that practicing with the instructions that Ute Janiya gives has enabled him to be comfortable with whatever arises. Anything that comes is okay now, whereas before he used to think, oh, this is a valid experience, this is not a valid experience. This is a meditative experience, this is not a meditative experience. And now he says, I can be with anything that comes up. It doesn't matter what comes up. I just have to look at it. I just have to experience what's going on without this judging. This is okay and this is not okay. In fact, I think it was with this person that I was talking, and I said, I don't know how old you are, but there was a book many years ago by a psychologist, Eric Byrne, You're Okay, I'm Okay. It's like, we're all okay now. You know, it's not like somebody's a good yogi and someone's a bad yogi because I'm having this experience and you're having that experience. So thank you for sharing that. No questions? How about comments? So if there are no more questions or comments, I'd like to just say thank you again, and I'd like to dedicate the merit of our sitting together and of listening and talking together. I'd like to dedicate that merit to the happiness and peace and well-being of all beings everywhere, everyone here and all beings everywhere. Thank you and be well.